The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good evening. Welcome, everyone. So tonight, I was thinking of exploring how the quality of love, of kindness, of compassion is kind of woven through the whole path of our practice. We often, I think, you know, just the framing of the way the Buddha taught, he sometimes said, "What I teach is suffering and the end of suffering." And so we can kind of orient that way, looking at our struggles. And in fact, when we begin to explore mindfulness for the first time, sometimes what we really begin to see is just how much our mind is racing and confused and aversive and wanting things, and we really see the struggles and the suffering of our minds as we begin to practice this path. And so the Buddha's teachings on understanding suffering, understanding stress, understanding how our minds do this and get caught in struggle, it's very appropriate in many ways to orient that way and to begin to recognize that understanding suffering is a big part of this path. And also, as that path develops, as that path is cultivated, as we do begin to explore and understand the ways that our minds get caught and struggle, the various patterns and habits of our mind around which we suffer a lot around the habits and patterns of our mind. As we begin to explore those and understand them, one of the teachings of the Buddha in one particular sutta, one particular discourse of the Buddha that I've really come to appreciate, he describes a path of practice where the first thing that we do is really understand our struggles. So we understand suffering. And as that happens, the path that unfolds leads to the open heart of love, of compassion, of joy. And so I wanted to explore that. How does that happen? What is going on there? Because on the face of it, letting go of our struggles doesn't necessarily seem like it would lead to these beautiful emotions. And so I thought I'd take a few minutes exploring the qualities themselves, and then to explore how they are developed and cultivated as we practice on this path. I thought I'd use the Eightfold Path as the framework for this, the Buddha's teaching on how the path unfolds. So there are four qualities that are often grouped together that are the relational, beautiful relational emotions that are both cultivated as we practice and revealed as we practice, I think. And these four are loving kindness or metta, compassion or karuna in the Pali, joy. Often in the relational sense, it's sympathetic or empathetic joy, joy for the success, the happiness of another person's success or happiness. And then the fourth is what's called equanimity or upekkha, and that is a kind of the balancing factor that allows us to open our hearts in the other three ways. Because the open heart of metta, the open heart of loving kindness, I would say it's really a non-contracted response to the world. It's a heart that is open and receptive and meets the world without fear, without reactivity, without wanting to hold on to anything or push anything away. And that's the quality of loving kindness itself, of metta itself. It's really a non-contracted, an openness, an open quality to the heart. And that open heart, as it goes through the world, as it goes through our day and listens to the news and sees our friends, that quality of the open heart will resonate with what's happening in the world. If that open heart is meeting suffering, the natural response of that open heart, of that heart that doesn't contract, is compassion. Now you can see how in going through the world, if we are meeting suffering, sometimes we can react out of fear, out of confusion, out of anger, aversion, of self-righteousness, of lots of different reactivity, irritation, annoyance, from the minor to the large. When we meet suffering in the world, often that is a response. And it is possible, the teaching of these beautiful qualities of heart teach that it's possible to meet the world with that open heart and not contract. And that response is compassion. And the heart moving through the world, when it meets beauty and joy and happiness of others in the world, that response is a response of sympathetic or empathetic joy. That we take delight when others are happy, that we take delight when others have success. It's really a very beautiful emotion, this quality of sympathetic joy. I remember an early time, it was on one of my retreats when I really began to touch into this quality. And I was watching a friend doing walking meditation, and it just I just had the sense of the stillness and the presence of her mind, and that just brought so much joy for me to see that. And that was a beautiful thing, because only a few months or a year or so prior to that, I had been exploring this quality of metta and began discovering that I had this idea that if I was wishing for somebody else to be happy, it meant that I was basically wishing that I would not be happy, that I thought in a way of happiness as a zero-sum game, that if somebody else was happy, it meant there was less of it for me. And what I discovered is with this quality of the open heart that is simply resonating with the world, resonating with happiness, happiness multiplies itself in this way. It's not that there's only so much to go around. Now, there is one thing I think in our usual way of defining happiness is having what we want, where having what we want is often having material things, having money, having a job, having a relationship, having whatever we want to have. If we want to have possessions and material things, there are only so many material things in the world. And so if that's how we're defining our happiness, there will be a contraction when somebody else gets what they get, when somebody else has happiness. And so this is an interesting exploration around joy, of the possibility of recognizing that a deeper kind of happiness comes from not necessarily having what we want, but from letting go of demands and expectations. And this is part of the path. This is part of the path of practice, to see how our orientation, our usual orientation towards the world, is happiness comes from getting what I want. And it's happened so much that way. I mean, that's basically been the way we've lived our lives. And it has happened that we have had a form of happiness from getting what we want. And it's happened so many times that way that we think that's the only way to be happy. And this was a real key point of the Buddha's teaching, that his discovery of a deeper kind of happiness comes not from having what we want, but from being at ease with the way things are, essentially letting go of the need for things to be a certain way. So the open heart resonating in the world with suffering and with joy. And the equanimity, the fourth of these, the balance of mind, basically is what allows the heart to be able to stretch, to stretch, to stretch, to be able to meet all the joys and all the sorrows of the world without being knocked off of balance, without being reactive about the suffering and about the joy. So, how is it that these qualities are developed in the path of being aware of our experience, moment to moment? I'd like to explore this by looking at the Eightfold Path. The Buddhist teaching on the Eightfold Path is his kind of framework of the way the path unfolds. And I'll just name them first, and then I'll go through each one and explore how the qualities of love fit in to this path. It was really quite a lovely exploration when I decided to do this. I thought, gosh, the Buddha says that this love develops naturally as we go, so it must be in there. And I looked at every single one of the factors of the Eightfold Path, and I found it in every single one. And so that's what I wanted to share with you tonight. So I'll just name them first. There's wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And so the path begins with wise view. And a typical framing of wise view is understanding suffering. It is the Four Noble Truths. And so again, it's like, okay, understanding suffering, how does this fit with love? What is this? So, the wise view is this framework of understanding suffering, recognizing that the cause of suffering is this contraction of heart, this wanting things to be other than they are. This essentially, it's the opposite of that heart that is open and receptive and moving through the world with able to meet suffering and joy. So the cause of suffering is this contractedness, this wanting things to be other than they are. And then the third noble truth is the possibility for the suffering to come to an end. And the fourth noble truth is this path, the Eightfold Path. So that's one of the classic ways that the wise view is defined. And there's another way that it's defined. It's defined as basically understanding what is wholesome and helpful for us in terms of leading us towards this ending of suffering, and what is not helpful, what gets in our way. And this is really, I think, where love really fits in one of the places love is more obvious in this, in wise view. That the understanding is that what gets in our way of the coming to the ending of suffering are qualities of heart and mind that are contracted and closed. Qualities of greed, of aversion, and of delusion, of confusion. Qualities that support us towards the ending of suffering. And you know, the Buddha used it that way, he framed it that way, that suffering comes to an end. But he also called that ending of suffering the great happiness. And so we can look at what are the qualities that lead us towards happiness. What are the qualities that lead us towards well-being? And they are framed in the negative as non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. And it's interesting that in the Pali, often the positive form of a word is the same as the negation of the negative of the word. And so sometimes love is equated to the absence of hatred or the absence of aversion. And so there, right there, that in the Buddhist framework of wise view, it's helpful to cultivate non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, or put in the positive form, it's helpful to cultivate generosity, love, and wisdom. Then the second factor of the path, wise intention, is basically the intention to act on what is helpful, what is skillful. So the intention to act on generosity, love, and wisdom. So we can think about the path both as being an exploration of letting go of the things that get in the way of our happiness, and cultivating those things that help us move towards happiness and help us move towards well-being. And these, both of these support each other. The very action of cultivating the, or letting go, or exploring what gets in the way of that happiness, exploring what gets in the way or what leads us to suffering. As we explore that, we start to see those patterns of contraction, of greed, of confusion, of wanting to get rid of things. We begin to see that the mindfulness begins to see and to understand that those states of mind, right in themselves, are not leading to well-being. And so the mind begins to let go of those and orient more towards love and generosity and wisdom. The next aspect of the Eightfold Path, I'm just going to cover really briefly, it's the ethical aspect of the Eightfold Path of wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. And this, I think, is an interesting area to explore and reflect on with respect to love and compassion, particularly with love and compassion, because the framing of these aspects of wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood, they're framed in terms of non-harming. So refraining from false speech, harsh speech, divisive speech, idle chatter, refraining from killing living beings, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from acting in a harmful way with our sexuality, and acting or having a livelihood that creates harm in the world. And so this aspect of the Eightfold Path is really an orientation towards non-harming, where non-harming is the refraining from actions that harm. And what happens as we do that, if we are open to it, if we are interested in exploring our minds and our hearts, as we refrain from harming, it simultaneously begins to cultivate connection, love, and compassion. It does this, I think, mostly if we are, not following these guidelines. We can think of these aspects around ethical conduct as guidelines for our behavior, guidelines for our conduct. And we can take on this conduct in a way that's kind of like rules of behavior. Thou shalt not, and just kind of rigidly follow rules. and say, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to do that. And if we're engaging with them in that way, we're not actively engaging with our heart. It's much more of a rigidity, a much more of a, this is right and this is wrong. The Buddha's teaching on non-harming is asking us to explore our hearts as well. So how is it? What happens as we have the impulse towards harm and refrain from that impulse? What happens in our heart? I had a demonstration of this fairly early in my practice, of how this works, of how this refraining from harming leads to kind of this connectedness. And this is, I think this is an interesting aspect of these four qualities of heart. They are relational emotions. Love, compassion, sympathetic joy are particularly relational emotions. The equanimity can be relational, or it can be kind of more balance of mind just in our own experience. But it is relational, too, in certain ways. And if I have time, I'll talk about that a little bit later. So the love, loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy are very relational emotions. They are how we connect to the world when our heart is not contracted. And the aspect of the Eightfold Path around conduct is very relational also. This is looking at how we relate to our fellow human beings through our actions, through fellow beings through our actions. Not just our human beings, but also all beings. How do we relate to beings through our actions? And so this is also a very relational aspect of the teaching. And so the exploration of love here comes right in that exploration of relationship. So early in my practice, I had a period of time where the ants in my kitchen were quite invasive. They were there a lot, and I worked with them in many different ways. At one point, one of the things I would do would just be remove the thing that they were after, and then, you know, see if they'd go away. And often, I had a cat at the time, and so often they were coming after the cat food, and I built, like, little moats, you know, around the cat food, and they built bridges with their bodies to get to the cat food. It was like, it was amazing. I mean, I learned a lot about ants and their habitats and their habits, you know. It's like I was connecting to the ants as I was doing this exploration. One day I went into the kitchen, and there was a line of ants about 3 inches deep all around the surface of the ceiling. And I had to go to work, and I looked up at the ants, and I said, okay, I have to go to work now, and if you're still there when I get back, I'm going to have to use some poison on you. And I walked out of the house, and I came back, and they were gone. So I did not have to take the raid to the ants. I was very glad that they had moved on. I think that they were moving their nest or something. I don't know what they were doing. And then another time, they seemed to like come out onto my counters a lot, and at one point I got into this practice of I saw where they were coming in. They seemed to come in this one spot near the window. And so I would create a corral of soap around the ants, you know, come to the farthest reach of where they were, and I'd create a corral of soap around the ants. And then I would slowly make the corral smaller so that they would go back. This was a long process. And after some days of working with this process, I decided to speed things up. And I took a piece of paper, and I would scoop up the ants. So I corralled them, and then I'd scoop up the ones in the corral, and I'd deposit them back by the place where they were coming in. And after some time of doing that, I saw this one ant by the place where they were coming in. I saw one ant standing there. And I had also seen that they communicated, right? Every time they came and went from anywhere, they touched their antenna. So it's like every time they met another ant, they were touching antennas. So they were communicating with each other. I could see that was going on. And then I saw this one ant that was it was by the place where they were coming and going. And this ant was doing something I'd never seen an ant do before. It was standing on its two back legs, and it was scanning the environment like this. And I had never seen an ant do this before, but what it evoked for me, and this is anthropomorphic, I don't know what it was going on for the ant, but what it evoked for me was alarm. It evoked the quality of alarm in the ant colony. And as I saw that, and as I felt that, the response in my heart was compassion. I had not been trying to cultivate compassion. I had been trying not to kill the ants and to keep my heart as open to them as I could while I was doing that. And I discovered compassion. It was quite an amazing discovery. So these practices of non-harming are direct connections to these beautiful qualities of love, of joy, of compassion. The next aspect of the Eightfold Path is wise effort. And this aspect of the Eightfold Path also pretty directly connects to love, to loving kindness, because this is the place in the path where the Buddha says we need to actively make effort to cultivate those skillful qualities that lead to the end of suffering, and actively let go of those qualities that lead us towards suffering. So this is the effort of our practice, to actively cultivate the qualities of love, of compassion, of joy, of equanimity, of mindfulness, of concentration, of ease, of peace. So many skillful qualities that help lead to the end of suffering. Now, I'd like to explore here the next factor of the Eightfold Path, because I mentioned mindfulness as being one of the wholesome qualities that's cultivated. And this is, I think mindfulness is really one of the core wholesome qualities. And without mindfulness, joined with this perspective of cultivate the wholesome, let go of the unwholesome, without mindfulness, the path doesn't go very far. Because without mindfulness, our minds are kind of running down their habitual course. They're running on autopilot, engaging in the world in the way that we're used to engaging in the world, which often includes reactivity, contracted heart, confusion, aversion, greed. So not always. That's not always our response to the world. But without some degree of mindfulness, it's very hard to tease apart the times when our minds are engaged in wholesome activities and when our minds are stuck in confusion and reactivity. And so that the quality of mindfulness is one of the most wholesome qualities to cultivate. And all of the other qualities, in order to cultivate any of the other qualities, we need mindfulness. So, for instance, we can actively cultivate metta, but we need mindfulness to do that. We can engage in the practice. There's some formal practices of cultivating these wholesome qualities of the formal practices of loving kindness, of compassion, of sympathetic joy, of equanimity involve a reflective practice. They involve saying a phrase, saying reflective phrases that are orienting us towards that quality. So for instance, for loving kindness, we bring in the reflections, may I be happy, may you be happy, may all beings be happy, may I be at ease, may you be at ease, may all beings be at ease, may I be healthy, may you be healthy. So we bring in this connectedness or open-heartedness through actively thinking thoughts of goodwill, thinking thoughts of kindness, thinking thoughts of well-being. In order to do that and have an impact on us, we need to be mindful. If we're just sitting there kind of rote, in a rote way, saying, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy, it may lead to some concentration because the mind is saying the same phrase over and over again, but it's not connecting with the meaning of the phrase. It takes mindfulness to connect with the meaning of the phrase, and it's the connection of the meaning that begins to cultivate that quality in our hearts. As we express that wish, may you be happy, and understand the meaning, it's kind of orienting the heart towards that wish. Whether or not we feel it, it's like directing our heart, pointing our heart in that direction. When we are mindful of it, it begins to point our hearts in that direction. And so we need mindfulness to cultivate any of the other wholesome qualities. And so this is the next aspect of the Eightfold Path, wise mindfulness. Mindfulness functions in so many different ways in our practice. It's basically a simple quality of mind. We can look at it as a simple quality of mind that allows us to know what's happening in the present moment while it's happening. And one way that we can actively cultivate these beautiful qualities of love, of compassion, of sympathetic joy, of equanimity, is to be mindful of them when they are present. We recognize them when they arise. This can actually be a practice. We can explore our experience through this lens and recognize, when is love present? When is love not present? Not being judgmental about it, but just being very honest. When is that open-hearted connection there? When is it not there? My description of when I saw my friend doing walking meditation and just felt my heart with joy for her, that was recognizing that quality of sympathetic joy just right there in the moment. And so we can kind of orient towards that and see, do we recognize this quality of this open heart? Recognize when compassion arises. When do we feel when we meet suffering, are there times when we can actually meet that suffering without contraction, without fear, but really meet it with an open heart? Can we meet our friends who are suffering without needing to fix them or change them or tell them what they need to do, but be there with them? It's very powerful to be a witness to someone's suffering. More powerful than you might imagine. You know, just the simple being a witness can allow somebody to go through a process and feel held in that process. We can do this for others. It's a beautiful thing when we can do it for others. If somebody is suffering, I think you may know this from your own side. I mean, I know that for myself, I went through a period of time where I had a frozen shoulder, and there was a lot of pain in the frozen shoulder, and you know, and every now and then people would ask me how I was, and inevitably they would tell me what I should do about the frozen shoulder. And this frozen shoulder lasted for about a year and a half, and you know, I didn't really want to hear everybody's advice. But a little bit of, gosh, I hope it gets better, you know, that would have been a lovely thing to hear. So You know, and one time I also found myself in a situation where somebody was going through a very painful memory, and I was present enough to realize I could be there for that friend, and I couldn't do anything else. I could just be there for them. And I tried in that experience, I tried to just be as open as I could, as non-reactive as I could, as present as I could for my friend's suffering. And he came back to me a couple days later and asked me what I was doing. He asked me if I was doing metta for him. And I wasn't consciously doing metta for him, but I was consciously trying to be present. And this is another place that metta and mindfulness intersect. They completely intersect. My practice of being present was transmitted in a way as compassion, as love, as kindness. And so we can do this for others, and we can do it for ourselves. It's quite powerful for us to witness our own suffering. It has the same healing effect, that witness, the loving witness. We could call mindfulness a loving witness, a loving witness for our own suffering or the suffering of others. And then, you know, if we are oriented for perhaps, so this is a kind of very direct way that mindfulness and love intersect, it might not be so obvious how it relates when we're looking at something like anger or frustration or confusion. You know, again, that we may be orienting towards being mindful of the experience of anger and aware of the experience of anger and the unpleasantness of that. And boy, love does not feel like it's in the equation at all. And yet there is that, if that mindfulness has that non-reactive meeting of that anger, while we are cultivating the mindfulness of that anger, we are also cultivating that quality of presence that contains kindness. The non-reactivity of mindfulness contains that compassion, contains that kindness. It may not be felt immediately or directly, but it is being cultivated, almost like that way that, you know, I think that the whole time I was working with the ants in my kitchen, compassion was being cultivated, but I didn't really see it until that one experience where I saw the ant doing that funny gesture. So sometimes we might have to actively turn towards connection to actually see the feelings or to experience the feelings of love while we are cultivating mindfulness. So an experience for myself around this, you know, I described the story of being present for my friend. And what I felt like I was doing, the activity of mind, was trying to be as connected and present as I could. I wasn't conscious of feeling compassion, and I wasn't conscious of feeling the metta, but I was trying to be as present as I could. And around that time, I had a number of people telling me when I was sitting with them and talking with them that they so felt my compassion. And I was sitting there thinking, huh, you know, that's not my experience. I feel like I'm really here, I'm really present, but I don't actively feel the compassion. And I talked about this to one of my teachers, and he said, you're orienting towards wisdom. You're orienting towards mindfulness, essentially. You're orienting towards just knowing what's happening in the moment. He said, turn towards the connection when you do that. And so the very next opportunity I had, which was like 5 minutes later, I was sitting in front of somebody and feeling very present. And I thought, oh, here's an opportunity. What is it like to orient and recognize this is another being? I'm in relationship with another being right here. The sense of love, of connection, was very present. So it was there. It just hadn't been opened to. And so sometimes we might need to consciously turn towards the sense of connection. These are relational emotions, remember. Let's turn toward the sense of connection to open to that feeling. The last aspect of the Eightfold Path is wise concentration. And wise concentration is it's a place, essentially. We can call wise concentration where the mind is stable and not reactive. When the mindfulness becomes stable in the present moment, continuous over time, the mind is non-distracted. It's not able to be pushed off kilter. And so the mind is more balanced, it's non-reactive, and this is that quality of equanimity. When the mind is in wise concentration, the quality of equanimity is very close. Non-reactivity. The experience of concentration essentially gives us a taste of some of the most beautiful of the emotions that come along with the practice. Peace, ease, happiness, bliss, delight are very accessible in the state of concentration. And from that place, turning towards connection, one thing I discovered in Burma, Burmese teacher told me I should practice metta at the beginning of every sitting. And up to that point, I had not had very good relationship with practicing metta formally. Every time I'd practiced it, the mind would get very reactive. And so I had let go of the practice, the formal practice of metta, and recognized that for me, having the mindfulness, I was seeing that there was benefit and that the mindfulness practice was cultivating the quality of metta. And so I let myself be satisfied with that. And I didn't try to go the route of the active cultivation of metta through, you know, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I be safe, may you be happy. It would just tie me in knots to try to do that. So I let that go. But at the beginning of my sittings, it was pretty far into my retreat. It was a 4.5 month retreat in Burma. And I was fairly concentrated. And when I sat down and touched into my state of concentration, I sat down in my sitting and felt into my experience there, and the mind was pretty happy. It was very settled, very at ease. And when I turned towards connection from that place of concentration, there was no question in my mind, oh yes, may everyone feel this way. It was such a non-conflicted kind of state that my heart opened and thought, wow, if everyone could feel this, wow, the world would be a so much happier place. So yes, may all beings have this. May all beings feel this way. So wise concentration opens us to a place where it's very easy for that wish for happiness, for all beings, for that connection to all beings to come about. So metta is basically this, at a very simple level, it is a wish for well-being. The wish for well-being for ourselves and for others. And that wish is a very natural wish. It's a very wholesome wish. And it is understood to be, the wish for ourselves to be happy, at least, is understood to be just a very natural wish. The Buddha said, you know, that just, you know, that he would ask people, do you wish yourself happy? Of course, yes, I wish myself happy. Well, then wish it for others as well. Now, in our culture, we seem to have a very confused relationship to this wish. I certainly did, and this is why it was so difficult to wish metta, because I felt like I didn't deserve to be happy. So, you know, we have this in our culture. It seems apparently, maybe it's unique to the Western cultures, this idea of self-hatred and not thinking that we can be happy or not wishing ourselves well. It seemed that, you know, the Dalai Lama, apparently, in a famous exchange, somebody asked him what to do about these feelings of self-hatred, and the translator had to go back and forth with him a long time to explain what he even meant. It just wasn't a concept that the Dalai, apparently wasn't a concept that the Dalai Lama was familiar with. So we do have this kind of conflicted relationship, but I think at the core, and what I've seen for myself is that at our core there is this wish for happiness. It's just that there's so many things layered on top of it. Fear, confusion, self-judgment, so many different reactions layered on top of it, that it's kind of swamped into the middle of our experience. And so I think there is, you know, and in some ways, our reactivity to the world is in some ways, when we look back to the middle of it, at some level, when we're afraid of something, it's because we want to be safe. When we are feeling like we're being denied something, it's because we wish to be happy. The wishes for our happiness, our safety, our health, our well-being, are very natural wishes that get kind of confused and mixed up. Because it is basically because of the reality of the world that things are impermanent, they're unreliable, and they're not ultimately in our control. And so those truths or those realities of the world come into conflict with these deep wishes. You know, the deep wishes for happiness and well-being, we see, you know, well, in the way that we usually think we want to be happy, by having what we want, by getting what we want, yes, that's in conflict with the reality of impermanence, the reality of unreliability, the reality that things are not in our control, that we can't always control things and get what we want. So the orientation, our usual orientation to the world, has these two wishes the deep wishes for happiness in conflict with the reality of the world. And the paradox of this path is that we can both open to those deep wishes and be fully living that wish for our own happiness and well-being, and in complete alignment with the truth that things are impermanent, unreliable, and out of control. It's possible for those two to exist simultaneously without conflict. And that happens as we begin to see that our usual habitual ways of trying to find happiness are really a lesser form of happiness. Having what we want, it gives us some happiness for a few moments, and then it goes away, and then we're on the wheel trying to get the next bit of happiness, and the next, and the next, and it's like this endless running. Somebody reminded me the other day of the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland. It takes all the running you can do here to stay in one place. That's what it feels like to have that kind of happiness. It takes all the running we can do to stay in one place. And the Buddha found and pointed to a deeper kind of happiness that comes not from getting what we want, not from having what we want, but from releasing the wanting, releasing the need for it to be a certain way. And that creates a deeper kind of happiness that points to that wise concentration that is the kind of happiness that can be shared with the whole world without a sense of it being giving something away. In fact, it multiplies that happiness. So I talked longer than I thought I would. It's basically time to stop. And it occurs to me that the next time, I'm not here next week, but the following week, what I'll talk about is the many ways, the many different kinds of happinesses there are in this path. So I'll follow this exploration of love with an exploration of happiness in 2 weeks. So thank you for your attention.